Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with journalist Ruth Laney about her book, Cherie Quarters, The Place and the People That Inspired Ernest J. Gaines. And we'll hear from Abram Himmelstein, the editor-in-chief at the University of New Orleans Press, and Chelsea Shannon, a full-time editor at UNO Press, about their new project, a self-publishing intensive course. That's coming up in January. It is a great pleasure to welcome journalist Ruth Laney to The Reading Life to talk about her book, Cherie Quarters, The Place and the People That Inspired Ernest J. Gaines. Ruth has written about this Louisiana writer for many publications, and she also wrote and co-produced the 1993 television documentary Ernest Gaines, Louisiana Stories, and was active in the efforts to preserve Cherie Quarters. Ruth Laney, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
This book is so many things. It's a biography of a great Louisiana writer, a portrait of a place that inspired him, a chronicle of the race against time to save that place, and a chorus of the voices of the people who lived there. So why don't we begin at the very beginning on that day in 1972 when you first met Ernest Gaines?
I was working at LSU Press as a copy editor, and we were in Hill Memorial Library then, and Charles East was, he may have been the director at that time, or he may have been associate director, and he came upstairs and kind of rapped on the door, and, you know, our offices, copy editors, there were four of us, and he introduced a man as Ernest Gaines, and Mr. Gaines was holding a beret in his hands, and then he had a couple of books in his hands. And one was the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, and the other was his book of short stories, Bloodline. And Charles said he was in town visiting from San Francisco to help select sites for the filming of the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. It was a CBS television film. And he said he's going to give a reading later on this afternoon. And if anybody up here wants to go hear him read, you're welcome to take off from work and go. And so at 2:30 in the afternoon, Beverly Jarrett, who was the head editor then, and she later went on to be the director of University of Missouri Press, she and I walked over to Lockett Hall, just a few feet away, and it was a classroom. And Warren Eister was the creative writing teacher who had invited Gaines to speak to his class. And then a few professors wandered in. So it was a mix of students and teachers. Eister introduced him, and he said he's going to read a short story that's told from multiple points of view, and so I'd like for my students to pay attention to that. And Ernest Gaines read the short story Just Like a Tree, which is the last story in the book Bloodline, which is a collection of five of his short stories. As Eister said, it's told from multiple points of view. It starts off with a family in a wagon pulled by mules, and I think the first speaker is it's a little boy named Chucky, and the father is driving, you know, the mules, one of whom won't pull. He's just kind of riding along while the other horse, while the other mule does all the pulling. And then the grandmother has insisted on bringing her setting chair, you know, and she's got that in the wagon and she's sitting in it. And so that, you know, it's humorous. It's a funny introduction to characters in the story. And so you immediately get a picture of a family, the kind of obnoxious grandmother who insists on having her own chair. And he lets Chucky take the reins, and Chucky proceeds to knock down the fence of the house they're going to. So, you know, it starts off with humor. But the central figure in the story is Aunt Fee, and she's an old lady who is basically being forced to leave her home because of civil rights activities that are starting up. And the title, Just Like a Tree, is based on the spiritual, just like a tree standing beside the water, I shall not be moved. Mm-hmm. So each character speaks. There's one wonderful character, Aunt Chloe, who would, you know, apparently be another woman of Aunt Fee's age. And she talks about what it's like when you rip a tree, you know, cut down a tree, a beautiful old oak tree, but you never can get the taproot. You jump down in there and you chop it with your axe, but you don't get the taproot. And she says, what's gone? And then you've got two holes left, a big hole in the ground and another big hole in the air where all the lovely branches have been all those years. Mm. I was just fascinated. I turned to Beverly Jarrett, who was sitting there next to me, and I said, I'm going to see if I can interview him. And I had never interviewed anybody.
But it was the sort of person you'd want to interview, of course.
Absolutely. It was like, I have got to hear more of this story.
Well, as you piece together his life story in Louisiana and San Francisco, you identified a lot of key moments. And one of them, of course, really spoke to my heart, and it's his love of libraries.
Yes.
And I wonder if you talk a little bit about that.
Yes, that's just a wonderful story. Living in Pointe-Coupee, you know, he had gone to school at the little church/schoolhouse. And then when he got to a certain age, he went to a black Catholic school in New Roads called St. Augustine. And that was it then, you know, eighth grade and you were done. Mm-hmm. There was no high school in Pointe-Coupee Parish that he could attend. I think his mother particularly wanted to get him out of Louisiana. I think they recognized he's really smart.
He was the chosen one.
Yeah,
in a way.
Education is definitely in his future. And the story he always told was Vallejo was a naval town with lots of sailors and bars. You know, he was going to school with kids, and I guess, you know, kids from the neighborhood, and they'd hang out on street corners. And his stepfather told him, I want you to get off the street. He first told the story, it was either the Y, you know, the YMCA or the library. And then later he added movies. But the first time I think he told it to me for the interview that ended up in Southern Review, it was just the Y. And he got beat up by he stepped into the boxing ring and the other guy beat him up. So that was the end of the Y. Well, he said he didn't want to go back because they would make fun of him. So he went to the library, and I think both of these were walking distance from the house where they lived, mm-hmm. or apartment. You know, he got a card. It was a beautiful, beautiful library, which unfortunately was torn down. It was built in 1904. It was Carnegie Library, and it had free to all carved into the facade on the outside. The second story was where the fiction was. And so when he got to that floor, he started looking at books. And he said, you know, I was looking for anything with trees, rivers, country. And, you know, I was looking for the kind of place that I had left. and the people I had left and wasn't finding it. And so he decided to write his own book.
A lot of people ask me who the greatest writer I've ever met is. And as a person, I would have to say I think Ernest Gaines is.
Yeah, I do think he's never gotten the respect. He's not as well known as he should be. Oprah helped a lot. You know, when Oprah picked A Lesson Before Dying, I think they sold 950,000 copies. That was certainly a big help. But even now, I think there are people who don't know who he is, and they should.
Well, you have certainly done your part to make sure that people know him and know his work. So we've been talking with Ruth Laney, whose new book is Cherie Quarters, The Place and the People That Inspired Ernest J. Gaines. Ruth, thank you so much, and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you.
I am so happy to welcome Abram Himmelstein, the editor-in-chief at the University of New Orleans Press, and Chelsea Shannon, a full-time editor at the UNO Press, to talk about their new project, a self-publishing intensive course. It's coming up January 3rd through 19th. Abram, hello.
Hello. It's good to be back.
Chelsea, making your debut.
Yes, hello.
Nice to see you. So tell us what you've got in mind for this self-publishing intensive. You both have such experience in both worlds, university press world, self-publishing. So you're going to do a little bit of everything.
Yes, we are doing a bit of everything. It will be a 3-week long intensive for anybody who has a manuscript that they are ready to share with the world. This could be a collection of poetry, flash fiction, it could be art-based, it could be something that defies genres, but really what we're wanting is to build this crucible where everybody can come in with their work and put it together, lay it out, visualize it, understand what it takes to take it from a file on the computer or a collection of poems in a drawer and turn it into a book that they'll get to walk away with.
And are there limits on length?
I guess, yes, to some degree, the length will determine how many copies they're coming away with. But yes, that'll be something we'll determine once we see the manuscripts.
Talk a little bit about your self-publishing experience, Chelsea.
Sure. Yes. So I'm coming to this mostly from doing zines.
Explain what a zine is for people who don't know, really.
I don't know. The ones I've done have been perzines or personal zines. So just small self-published books about anything that you want it to be about, essentially. But other zines are monthly or recurring. They can be anthological or they can be one person, but basically self-contained self-publications. I started making zines in my undergrad years, and I was a co-editor of a feminist monthly zine while I was an undergrad. So that was kind of my major entry, and I've continued making them since, kind of as a complement to, I don't want to say like the more serious writing, because that dichotomy feels false, but I guess the more public-facing writing. So yes, I have a passion for that, and I am excited to offer that way of making and that way of writing to other people.
Well, we have here your most recent zine, right? Mm-hmm. Trace Chasing, Time, Place, Race, and Emmett Till, which is such a beautiful little book. So talk about making that book and what it meant to have that total control over the finished product.
Yes, total control kind of meant that it sat on my computer for 4 years because I looked at what I'd written. I wrote the interior in like 2 days after I had the experience that I explain in the zine, and then felt that what I'd written was like so honest and just so raw in a sense. I really didn't know what I wanted to do with it from there now that it existed. And then something shifted 4 years later, and I decided I am ready to share this. And so our graphics person from UNO Press, Alex Demeff, helped me lay it out into actual pages, which was essential. And then I chose this gold paper for the cover, which felt key because we're dealing with legacies and we're dealing with grief and deep feeling and things that feel golden and deserving of that. So I was glad that that choice could come through.
Well, describe the journey you recount in this scene.
Sure. So it was 2018, the middle of the Trump years, and I was in the middle of my MFA program. And I took a road trip up to Cincinnati, which is where I'm originally from, to see my family and to retrieve some items from my house growing up to bring back down here to New Orleans. So already like embedded in this trip was this idea of home shifting and a keen sense of place and of memory. And I decided on my way back to New Orleans with that stuff in tow that I would pass through the Mississippi Delta area to see some of the places that were prominent in Emmett Till's life and death. Because that spring, I read his mother, Mamie Till Mobley's memoir, and wrote a paper about it and had been deeply moved by it. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'm already on the road. It is not that far from New Orleans. Like, it's on the way. So all of that kind of got folded into this trip. And within that, thoughts on my own loss, my loss of my father, thoughts on my family, lineage, diaspora, all of that just got kind of folded into this trip.
And it was the beginning of a search. You were deliberately searching for something in New Orleans.
Yes. I still am. Or I guess it's always emerging, searching for belonging or a sense of, I almost want to say sanctuary, but that's not right. Maybe sovereignty, something. And I think that being a Black person who's coming out of a great migration lineage and like growing up in the North, like there's always this sense like, the South is home, even though you've also maybe never been there and you have preconceived notions about it.
Right.
You know, and then to have chosen to move South, it's like, you know, I was trying to digest all of that and what it means for my identity and where and to whom I belong. And so kind of the figure of moving in the car and crossing all these state lines and seeing the scenery change and all of that was a compliment.
Well, it's just proof of how much you can pack into a small book like this.
Yeah.
So much beautiful photographs, incredible layout. It's really an amazing thing to look through.
Thank you.
Now, Abram, of course, Tales of a Punk Rock Nothing, one of the great titles of all time, and then co-founder of the Neighborhood Story Project. So talk a little bit about self-publishing in your life.
Well, my great-grandfather immigrated from Minsk into the Mississippi Delta, and in the Mississippi Delta, he ran a small shop, just like a dry goods store on Issaquena Avenue, which was the main drag in Clarksdale. And between customers, he would write poems, and at a certain point, he wrote a memoir, and there were no, I don't think he ever thought to send it anywhere, but he self-published two books of poetry and two books of memoir. And so it was always in my house something that seemed very possible. They're beautiful. They're you know, among the sacred objects in my life are my great-grandfather's volumes. And so when I was in the MFA program that Chelsea was in 20 years ago, I was shooting pool and had sent Tales of a Punk Rock Nothing off to be rejected by agents and publishers alike. And there was somebody with whom I was shooting pool on Monday night at Parkview and on Carrollton. And he's like, what do you do? I'm like, well, I'm a teacher and a writer. And I'm like, what do you do? And he's like, well, I'm a printer. I'm like, oh, how much would it cost to print 500 copies of a book? And he's like, well, let's say $2,000. So I lined up my thousand, and my partner in writing that book, Jamie Schweznettel, lined up his thousand, and we were off on a self-publishing adventure that we put the books in the back of the car, drove north, and sold 500 before we hit San Francisco. And then just kind of figured out the business and what publishing meant to us on the road. While we were on the road, we came to understand it was going well, and we ordered up 5,000 more, and those went quickly. And we ordered the next quantity we ordered was 10,000, and we learned how to publish. The first round had no ISBN, no barcode. Second round had an ISBN, no barcode. Third round had a barcode and looked and was, was selected into bookstores. And so we started selling them less on the street and more, tried to figure out how to do traditional publicity and the whole. And, you know, that positioned us. We ran a publishing company for about 5 years. And that was including a zine subscription service, which was amazing. And we got to be in contact with all these amazing writers who were, for better and for worse, but mostly for better, unfiltered. You know, we just really got to know that world, and I loved it and have always loved it, even while having really enjoyed the last 8 or 10 years that I've been in academic publishing.
Sure.
So.
Now, it seems to me that a lot of what you both are about in life and work and in this particular endeavor is demystifying publishing, you know, and democratizing publishing and getting more people to see the possibilities for themselves. Am I right?
Yes, you're right. And that's something I'm wanting to bring into the way we do the workshop portion of the course. I'm interested in trying a model where the person being workshopped comes in with the questions and kind of shapes the discussion about their work towards, I don't know, centering what it is the author wants out of the feedback from the group. And so it's more of a collaboration between the author and the people critiquing the author.
What kind of print run can someone expect from doing a book in this course?
I think we're looking at a minimum of 20 copies, although I think it'll depend greatly on kind of the cost, the length of the books. Yeah, those things, there's going to be a print budget of $200, and so that will buy you many copies of a short zine and fewer copies of a kind of novella if you choose to go that direction. So there are a lot of hard costs involved. You know, paper is among the most expensive commodities at the moment in terms of like what it's done year over year. You know, trees are a valuable resource, and that's our motto at UNO Press, is we try to have books that are more beautiful than trees, which is a high bar. It is a high bar. And so we're going to try and kind of extend that. We believe, like you said, in democratizing publishing. It's one of the most interesting parts of the publishing process to me. And the other part is like understanding the scarcity of the earth, that the resources of the earth, and treating those with respect and love. So the combination of those two are like this very powerful tension, because you want all humans to have that voice in print. I do think it's like among the ways in which humans understand themselves and feel most alive is by seeing that in a format in this technology called bookmaking, I think is beautiful. The other end of that is, you know, we don't want to waste a single tree. So.
Amen to that. And how many students do you think you can handle in this workshop?
We have 9, and the course is opened up to 15. So,
and do you think you'll make it part of the regular offerings?
That is the hope, yes.
That is the hope. That's a great hope. Well, excellent. I love this. This is going to be so exciting. Come back when you have books.
We are thrilled, and we're excited to come back with books in hand.
We've been talking with Abram Himmelstein and Chelsea Shannon of the University of New Orleans Press. They're offering a self-publishing intensive course. It's coming up January 3rd through 19th. Registration deadlines are January 1st for UNO students and December 9th if you need to enroll at UNO beforehand. For more information, you can write Abram at ahimelst@uno.edu. Abram, Chelsea, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure.
Always. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Poetry Buffet presents Dubravka Jurić, John Gary, and Biljana Obradović Saturday, December 3rd at 2 p.m. This is an online event. Check the Poetry Buffet Facebook page for the Zoom link. Christian Lee, Elizabeth Mickey Brina, and Emma Walsh read from their work Sunday, December 4th at 6 at the Always Lounge and Cabaret. Aaron McDowell will be at Levy Baking Company, 3138 Magazine Street, Suite D, to share her new book, Savory Baking, Recipes for Breakfast, Dinner, and Everything in Between. That's Monday, December 5th from 6 to 9. It's a ticketed hour event with a Q&A. Tickets available at GardenDistrictBookshop.com. Bruce Spicer will discuss the latest installment in his Beatles album series, The Beatles, Rubber Soul to Revolver, Monday, December 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Willow School presents a student creative writing showcase Tuesday, December 6th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books.
Writing Louisiana for Everyone is the theme for the 2022 Holiday Children's Book Festival. That takes place Wednesday, December 7th from 6 to 9 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Free of charge, open to the public, no registration. The theme, Writing Louisiana for Everyone, reflects the growing diversification of characters and plots in children's literature. There will be a panel discussion featuring three local children's authors, Chris Clarkson, Marty Dumas, and Johnette Downing. Anel Lopez and Stacy Balkin present Poetry and Pie, Thursday, December 8th at 6 at Windowsill Pies, 4714 Ferret Street. The Preservation Resource Center hosts the 47th Annual Holiday Home Tour and Boutique, December 10th and 11th. Book signings at the boutique at Louise McGee School, 2343 Britannia Street, take place from 11 to 3:30 each day. They include the following authors. On December 10th, Molly Kimball and Melanie Warner Spencer, John Pope, Chris Granger, and Danielle Del Sol, Ryan Fertel, David Ray Morris, and Ruth Laney. On December 11th, authors are Doug McCash, Matt Haynes, Liz Williams, and C.W. Cannon. For the complete schedule, check out prcno.org. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.